So I'll call our conference committee to order. Carlos Mariani, State Rep and Chair of the House Conferees. I'm joined by Chair Limmer, who's head of the Senate Conferees. And we have most of our members here at this point for the meeting. Let me just very quickly walk through what we hope to accomplish today. The House, of course, has the gavel today, so it's our duty to put together an agenda for today's conversation, and I hope it is a conversation. We will be focusing on firefighter provisions at this hearing. We'll explain a few bills related to that. We'll have some testimony on those, and then we'll have discussion among members. We'll then walk through emergency management response provisions in the House bill. There's four bills, two DFL bills and two Republican bills. We'll have the Department of We'll have someone from Homeland Security and Emergency Management, as well as the Director for Emergency Communications Network, speak to those provisions. And then we'll do a walkthrough of DWI enforcement provisions. We'll be hearing from the DWI task force on those two provisions in the House bill. And then we'll have a discussion after that, and then any closing statements and comments, observations that members have. Members, I'll start the way I've always started, which is to inquire of the Senate in regards to the five offers now that the House has put forward. This is the ninth day of our conferencing together. It's the end of our second week. I would say that, I just want to remind us all that the purpose for these meetings, first and foremost, is for us to get to agreement on a bill to make sure that our state's public safety, corrections, and then our court systems will continue to function, serving the people of Minnesota, and that their practices reflect our values as a people in our state. And so to make sure we've got, the best policy frameworks that capture that. I would add that, I think this has been actually a pretty rich experience the past couple of weeks, especially for, I would imagine, for the public that's tuned in. I know that quite a few members of the public have been paying attention to these hearings. I know that because I'm getting constant messages, as many of our members are, about the day's hearings. I would say that, if progress is measured by the public being aware of the issues that the legislature, is wrestling with and taking under consideration and the opportunities connected to that, then I think, this has been a successful series of conversations so far. I would also say that we've been successful if part of our purpose is to have the two houses make one another more aware of one another's legislative work. There's been a fair amount of that. Obviously, the House has a much larger bill, so there's been a lot more of sharing, if you will, from the House perspective. And so we've carefully, structured, our agendas when we have the gavel in order to do that. I also think that we've been successful if part of our purpose is also to bring in the voices of Minnesotans, so that obviously, it's senators and reps that need to make this decision. But we are a democracy. We prioritize transparency and engagement of the public, and we've had numerous public servants as well as regular citizens and activists, people impacted by our systems, come forward to speak on everything from criminal sexual conduct statutory reform to prison jail safety issues based on research and studies from our own State Department Office of Legislative Auditor. We've had we've also covered corrections, probation, resentencing reform, focus on second chance creation that can save taxpayer dollars and make us safer as well. And so, and of course, this committee has also heard some heartrending testimony from people most negatively impacted when things don't go well in our public safety systems. The horrible death of a beloved son in a county jail within the last couple of years, the sudden killing of another beloved son during a routine traffic stop. All of that really, I would argue, reminds us or should remind us to direct our public safety and correction systems to be better and to not produce these kind of outcomes. And I think our systems want to do that, and I think they need our help as legislators to guide and expect that and resource that for that. And yet, you know, we're almost 2 weeks in, and we still have not, you know, arrived at, you know, even the beginnings of a construct for an agreed-upon bill. We've got the May 17th deadline when the legislature is supposed to end successfully. And at this point, we're severely, severely challenged unless we actually begin to see some action in terms of idea exchanges and agreements around those ideas. And so it's that, you know, with that thinking that the House has put forward, you know, its offers, you know, steadily since last week. We won't be doing that today. There's plenty on the table. Our hope, of course, has been that the other body would reciprocate and at very least respond to that, and we've not, as of yet, heard a response. I did receive an email the other day, I think yesterday, from staff in the Minnesota Senate asking for a global offer, and that's still without a response to any of the offers that we've put forward. You know, action is a two-way street. It requires both people negotiating to take steps. I'm pretty proud that the House has taken some steps, and I'm still, you know, optimistically hopeful that the Senate will reciprocate as well. If it's the desire of the Senate to have a global offer, then my suggestion is to offer that as a counteroffer to the five offers that the House currently has before us. We need to respond to one another, folks. We need to meet the purpose for which we were created, and we need to do it soon. As I said, you know, we're scheduled to be concluded inside of 4 days. It can be done. I've been here when it's been done, and so I'll continue to remain optimistic, and hopefully today's agenda will help to provide more understanding of the House's proposals relative to these issues of firefighters, emergency management provisions, as well as our all-important DWI enforcement provisions in the bill. Chairman Limmer, I'll give you a minute to respond, and then we'll dive into the agenda.
Well, thank you, Chairman Mariani. I've got to admit, I'm beginning to learn a lot about your bill. It's 400 pages, I think, at last count, if you add up some of the added features that aren't formally in the bill. But nevertheless, it does take a little time to digest all of that material and the detail involved. I may want to just add one comment. We cannot pass this bill without a funding budget. That's really the purpose of this bill, and the House has certainly added its proposals, policy proposals onto that. But when it really comes down to it, we can't go forward eventually without a funding target. That either our leaders in the House and Senate and the governor have so far not arrived at. So I'm not so sure if the 4 days are really the time or not. I know that from a constitutional perspective, we will be ending the session, but we all know that the alternative is if we don't have a target within a reasonable amount of time, we'll have to enter into longer-term negotiations. The Senate bill, I might remind everyone that's listening, is a budget bill, spending bill, which funds our constitutional requirements. And many of our proposals that your House and we share are standing on standalone bills awaiting passage in the House, and they could literally be passed today and signed by the governor later this afternoon or tomorrow. So many of that discussion is already waiting. It's already been discussed in the Senate and awaiting House approval. So anyway, I know you have a different perspective on how to approach the issue. We are studying your five proposals of 54 separate provisions. And I'm just wondering, are you nearing the end of your description of your bill?
Chairman Leonard, we haven't covered all the aspects of our bill. What we've done is covered some of the more salient issues, particularly those issues that are on the top, in our opinion, is on the top most minds of most Minnesotans, like the policing issues, of which the Senate has had absolutely no hearings and have moved no bills to their Senate floor. And so the opportunity for the people of Minnesota to have any kind of legislative response to these kind of issues rests right here in front of us. And we certainly have the power to do that. We can construct a bill that addresses these important policy issues that is very typical of these omnibus bills, while also meeting the obligation that we do have. And actually, it's an obligation in both ways, but the additional obligation of making sure that we fund our public safety corrections and our court systems. We've done that before. You and I have done it. I think we can do it again. I think you and I probably need to lock arms together and go bang on the doors of our respective leaders and tell them to take care of that one aspect, while we, hopefully make headway on the other aspects of this bill. So I hopefully we can do that together, Senator Weber.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Chairman. So am I to conclude that the proposals you've already sent to us are a representation of your priorities in this bill?
Senator Limmer, they are representations of our priorities within the time frame that we've had. I think if we're able to continue to have an opportunity to engage with one another, a number of other provisions that we certainly would make sure that the Senate is aware of. But I would say you've heard some really important provisions here that I do think the people of Minnesota really want us to address.
All right.
Well, thank you, Senator Limmer. All right, members, so let's dive in. We're going to start with our firefighter provisions in the House bill.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry, Senator Letts. I always do this at the very beginning. I fail to look over in the Zoom on the right side where the hands are up, and there's actually a couple of folks. So Senator Letts and then Senator Ingridson as well wants to be recognized. Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will note that many other conference committees are doing very productive work in resolving language and policy differences between their the House and the Senate all week. I've known of some conference committees, I've been told, are close to being done with all of that, except for the budget numbers. So in fact, some of the conference committees have essentially set up, maybe you call them little subcommittees or at least working groups, for members of the House and the Senate addressing different topic areas or different proposals within the conference committee's bills, so that they can work on language and get their work done. All of that could have been done, but it hasn't happened in this conference committee. So they aren't waiting for targets. They're getting done all the work that can be done without having the numbers. It's just not happening here, and there's no reason other than a refusal to do so that it shouldn't be happening in this conference committee. The other thing I'm going to say, Mr. Chairman, is just a little procedural thing, which is to note that somewhere around 2 o'clock, I will be excusing myself from the conference committee. My son is going to be walking in an informal graduation ceremony from college. With all due respect to this process and the members here, to me, that's more important, and I will be there with my son and my family. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lantz, I learned a long time ago, now that I'm not only a dad, but a granddad, that we certainly do not need the permission of this body to meet that most important of all obligation. And that truly is not a partisan issue. Congratulations to you and to the family, to your son, and blessings and joy as he moves forward. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I can hold my questions after you go through today's presentation. I took a look at the agenda, so I can hold until then. And by the way, let's not forget about great grandpas. You know, there's very few of us on this committee that can say that. But congratulations, Senator Lantz.
Well said, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Very well. Let's move forward. I don't see any other hands. Chairman Lieber.
Just a quick note, Senator Lantz and I have one major thing in agreement we can crow about. I have a son who's graduating from the University of Minnesota also this week. He's decided to skip out on his graduation ceremony, and he and his wife are going to have a quick vacation of celebration in Florida right now. So I know that Senator Lantz and I agree on being very proud of our children getting through that major hurdle. Congratulations, Senator Lantz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I will note this this informal graduation ceremony is going to be outdoors and appropriately COVID safe, which is why. But yes, duly proud. My son's getting a mechanical engineering degree very proud, very excited, but thank you all.
Rightly so. Congratulations to both of you. Congratulations to the Limmer family. It's quite an accomplishment. And boy, we got a bunch of proud dads, maybe some proud moms as well on the committee here today. All right, let's move forward then. Our first part of the discussion then involves statewide firefighter issues. I'm going to ask our nonpartisan staff to walk through four of the provisions that we have in the omnibus bill. Actually, it's three provisions. One carried by Representative Frankie, addressing fire safety at petroleum refineries. One by Representative Huot, establishing the Firefighter Certification Board. And then piece of legislation offered by Representative Joaquin, the hometown, establishing the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program. So with that, I'll turn it over to our nonpartisan staff.
Mr. Chair, this is Jeff Diebel.
Mr. Diebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll walk through the three provisions under the fire safety topic. These are all found in Article 19 of the House bill, which is entitled Emergency Response and Fire Safety. The first bill listed is House File 1482, which, as the chair mentioned, is is authored by Representative Frankie. It requires each petroleum refinery operating in Minnesota to maintain or contract with a full-time, for a full-time on-site fire department. And the requires the refinery's fire departments to be properly trained, equipped, and staffed to respond to fires and unique situations that the risks of operating a petroleum refinery raise. Moving on to the second bill, this is Representative Hewlett's House File 2077. This is found in Article 19, and it's a series of sections, sections 3 through 7. The substance of the proposal is to establish the Firefighter Certification Board, and it's comprised of 18 members and is tasked with developing and maintaining a program to determine and certify the competency of firefighters in the state and among other tasks which are assigned to the board under the proposed statute. It also creates a firefighter certification account that is funded primarily with fees from individuals who apply for certification as a firefighters. And the funds and the language provides that the funds in the account are to be used for the activities that are assigned to the board. Moving to the third and final bill, this is Representative Joaquim's House File 377. It establishes a Hometown Heroes Assistance Program. It's the appropriation is found in the Public Safety Appropriation Article, and it appropriates $4 million each year for this program. The program would provide a grant to the Minnesota Firefighter Initiative to administer this program. The program is intended to provide one-time monetary payments to firefighters who are diagnosed with cancer, heart disease, or develop a, and also they can use the funds for developing a trauma counseling program for firefighters. And they're also tasked with developing training materials to reduce the inherent health risks of working as a firefighter. The one-time appropriations are available of up to $30,000 as provided in the statutory language. And it directs the firefighters initiative to establish criteria for disbursement of available grants. Mr. Chair, that concludes the overview of the three bills listed in the fire safety account or fire safety section.
Very well, thank you, Mr. Diebel. So next, members, we're going to hear some testimony on firefighter issues and referencing these provisions. So first, we're going to hear from BJ Jugman with MNFAC. And I'm forgetting exactly, acronyms and their full names don't always go together. And I've introduced you several times already, and I still, muff this one. So I'll let you describe MNFAC. For us, but welcome to the conference committee, Chief Jugman, and please state your name for the record and give us your thoughts and your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thanks for the introduction. I am BJ Jungman. I'm the fire chief for the city of Burnsville. I'd like to thank you for crafting the public safety omnibus bill and allowing me to testify during the process. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, which is called MNFAC. I'd like to thank Chair Mariani for the opportunity to testify. We are an organization comprised of four statewide associations, the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Association, the Minnesota Fire Marshals Association, and the Minnesota Chapter of the International Association of Arson Investigators. I'd like to start by thanking both public safety chairs and all of the committee members, including many important fire service provisions in the public safety bill. These provisions are important to the Minnesota Fire Service's mission. Thank you for keeping the fire safety account in track. Those funds include funding the State Fire Marshal's Office, the Board of Firefighter Training and Education, the Statewide Response Team, which include the hazmat teams, air rescue, and urban search and rescue, and other statewide worthwhile statewide projects that improve the fire services to the Minnesota citizens. These worthwhile projects far exceed the funding available. Just for some context for you, Minnesota ranks between 44th to 48th out of 50 states on spending for the fire service, according to the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. Also, over 90% of the Minnesota Fire Service is volunteer. This continues to be a challenge to recruit and retain firefighters while ensuring a high level of service to the community. We support the Hometown Heroes Act that helps with educating and mitigating three very important health topics of our firefighters. This includes emotional wellness, cancer prevention, and heart health. We also appreciate your support in the enabling legislation to move the Minnesota State Fire Service Certification Board under the Department of Public Safety and the State Fire Marshal's Office. This is a no-cost move for the state, as it is a fee for service. This move is supported by all five statewide fire service organizations. Certification is voluntary. The current certification board is a nonprofit, and the current executive director plans to retire at the end of their current contract. An RFP process was conducted, and the State Fire Marshal's Office was the only respondent. The current board voted overwhelmingly to move the certification function to the State Fire Marshal's Office. This transition is time-sensitive. It will also keep an oversight board that is made of the Minnesota Fire Service, both of Greater Minnesota and Metro. This transition will get the licensing, which is required for career firefighters, and certification, which is voluntary, under one roof, which will streamline the process for the Minnesota Fire Service. I'd like to thank Chair Limmer for working with us to better understand the policy and the time-sensitive nature of this issue. I appreciate all of your and the Chair's open door policy to discuss public safety issues and your willingness to collaborate with us. I would like to thank the chairs and all the committee members for your support. I'm happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Jungman. And yes, please, if you can hang on, that'd be great. We'll have open up for questions in a minute here. Next, we have George Espenson with Binfire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and honored members of this committee and all the other guests. My name is George Espenson. I'm the president of the Minnesota Firefighter Initiative, MinFire, as it's frequently referred to. I'm the retired fire chief from the city of Eden Prairie after 32 years of service for that fine organization and the people of the state of Minnesota. And during my career, I have seen countless examples of the deep and tragic impacts of cancer, cardiac, and emotional trauma. In fact, my immediate predecessor, Spencer Conrad, will be getting escorted home today from the hospital where he will spend his final days in hospice at his home after suffering the deep impacts of large B-cell lymphoma, which is the number one killer of firefighters in the country, and in particular in Minnesota, after his 30-plus years career as a volunteer fire chief. And so once again, a stunning and tragic example about what goes on in Minnesota. The Hometown Heroes Assistance Program seeks to do five things. One is to provide critical care, kind of like an Aflac-type benefit, to any firefighter in Minnesota who's diagnosed with cancer or cardiac issue. Because as all of us here know, no matter how great your health care is, when you have get involved in one of these long sagas with heart or cancer-related issues, the uncovered expenses, hotel, meals, food, going down to the mail, whatever your dilemma is, can bankrupt people regardless of how great their health care is. And so this would provide an immediate $20,000 benefit to any active firefighter in Minnesota on the issues of cancer or cardiac. Next, the bill addresses the need for emotional assistance for the fire service, specifically designed for firefighters, many of whom don't have access to emotional assistance programs, and will create an organization that will be firefighter-centric, because when firefighters call for emotional assistance, like you would normally with your EAP, often the issues are so disturbing to the untrained EAP people that they need EAP after hearing the journey that firefighters take through showing up at everybody else's worst day year after year, call after call. There will also be a scholarship fund for people that need more than those five visits a year. So if I didn't mention it, EAP is up to five visits per year for all 20,000 firefighters. Then a scholarship piece for people that need more assistance. Training for medical and mental health providers on the issues facing firefighters around the issues of cancer, cardiac, and emotional trauma. Frequently, when a firefighter goes to see their general practitioner, there's a lack of understanding, whether you're a career firefighter or a non-career slash volunteer firefighter, that you may have symptoms of fast-moving cancers that wouldn't commonly be seen in someone who's in their 30s or 40s. And so frequently goes misdiagnosed. And so this would provide annual training for all medical and mental health providers who wanted to avail themselves of that training. And then last and certainly not least and very critical is changing the culture of the fire service. Quite frankly, many of these things are preventable and mitigatable, but the fire service itself lacks a deep understanding. And we've been on this mission for a few years, but getting to every firefighter every year is a daunting task when you're trying to raise money through charitable donations and bake sales and selling baseball caps, et cetera. And we need to get to all 20,000 firefighters every year on the issues of cancer, cardiac, and emotional trauma, just like firefighters are required to do CPR training, EMT training, hazardous materials training, firefighter training, et cetera. This would be a similar kind of thing. So that's the bill in a nutshell. The benefit payable to firefighters was reduced from $30,000 per incident down to $20,000 so that we could meet that financial bogey of a $4 million annual cost. So that's the bulk of that reduction from our original bill, which was seeking $7.2 million. And very graciously, Chair Mariani and the Speaker and others and our author, you know, we worked with them collaboratively to adjust that pricing and still provide a meaningful benefit. So thank you for your time, and I stand for any questions.
Well, thank you, Chief Espenson, and my blessings, and I'm sure the entire committee's blessing to the Conrad family, your dear colleague. All right, so members, let's open this up for questions, comments, discussion. Senator Engelbrechtson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regards to the Hometown Heroes, it's $8 million over the biennium via the OJP. Can you give me an idea as to, once again, I was trying to pay attention here, but who's on the Men Fire Initiative Board, and how do they get on that board? I see it's less than 5 years old. Can you help me out with that, or whoever?
Chief Espenson, perhaps a little, background information, on MinFire itself.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Senator Ingebrigtsen. That's a great question. So our board is made up of leaders from the fire service, the professional firefighters, the state chiefs, and the volunteer firefighters who, the statewide organization. So that's the MPFF, the MSFDA, the Minnesota State Fire Department Association, and the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association are the members of the board.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So, Mr. Chair, you certainly can basically guarantee, I guess, or confirm that all of Minnesota, certainly rural Minnesota, is involved in that. But there's five members on there. What can you tell me where they're from?
Yes. So one of our members is Christopher Parsons. He's a St. Paul firefighter captain and current president of the MPFF. Mark Rosenblum, who is from Golden Valley. He's a recently retired firefighter and recent past president of the MSFDA, and he's going to be getting replaced by Dave Yurzik, who's the new president of the MSFDA. And Dave is from the somewhere between St. Cloud and Alexandria. I can never remember the exact city that he's from, but he's from the greater Minnesota area. Let's see, myself, I represent the State Chiefs Association as a past president of that organization. John Wolf, who is an assistant chief at St. Louis Park, which has a combination fire department, both career and non-career, and Mike Dobish, who's the fire chief in Richfield. And then we have one open seat, which we are looking to fill also mindfully from somewhere in greater Minnesota. That's our goal, is to have, you know, representation from around the state, and in particular, from the big three fire service organizations, which collectively represent all the firefighters in Minnesota.
Senator Engelbrechts.
No comment. Thank you. Yeah, I would just encourage you to, you know, certainly open that up to, you know, greater Minnesota is pretty big. It's pretty big, and you're probably referring to Sauk Center, I'm guessing, or even Melrose or Avon, one of them. But thanks, and I would encourage that kind of membership to get out to rural Minnesota, where the, you know, you certainly have, not predominantly, but I think all departments are volunteer, and they're having a hard time, of course, as you well know, recruiting for those as well. So thank you.
Good advice, Senator. Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope you can hear me. I'm having some audio issues that aren't matching up with my video, but I think you can. All right, great. So I just wanted to state my strong support for the Hometown Heroes program. And one of the things that struck me, as we heard from the testifier, was the ability for our firefighters to be able to get some of that emotional support. And I'll just say that attorneys already have that through Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers. Attorneys can actually get free counseling services because of trauma, vicarious trauma that's experienced on the job. And I just think that that is so critically important because, especially for our firefighters, we know how much trauma they're exposed to. And this is just something that's like a no-brainer for me to do. So thanks. I just wanted to make that comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. I note that it mirrors, mirrors might be the wrong word, but it's similar concern in terms of something that needs to be addressed that we find in our peace officer community as well. I know that the governor proposes critical incident intervention for our peace officers who face traumatic after effects after critical incidents. Something we spoke about quite a bit during last year's reform discussions with peace officers, understanding that the impact of certain events not only impact cause trauma to communities, but also to many, to the officers themselves who are involved. And so I think of it sort of, similar in terms of its impact. We're learning so much in the health sciences around about how our bodies carry with us, even as our minds push those events, into the recesses of our minds, but then our bodies still carry, that trauma with us. And I suspect, that part of the construct of the Hometown Heroes recognizes that by addressing both that emotional need as well as the high rates of physical ailments, particularly cancer and heart issues that many of our firefighters face. Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to talk about a couple things. I think I think the work that MnFIRE is doing in this Hometown Heroes Act is incredibly important. And I think, you know, the general public, when we think of firefighters, we actually think of the firefighting. But the reality is that our firefighters, you know, they're often the first ones that show up when there's, you know, a senior citizen who has a fall. If there are car accidents, you know, they are really the first ones on the scene. And I would encourage, especially if folks are vaccinated now, if you haven't done a ride along with your fire department, it has been one of the best things that I've done in my time in office and understanding the work that they do. I did want to talk a little bit too, and I also, you know, as someone who grew up in rural Minnesota and still have property in rural Minnesota, just wanted to talk too about, you know, the individual things that, you know, when you have an incident. We had an incident a couple years ago where a neighboring property owner didn't know what they were doing and were trying to do a burn, spread to our property, you know, potentially could have been even more disastrous, but because of our local volunteer fire department, as well as the efforts of the DNR, you know, we're able to control that. And so I think, you know, making sure that we're funding the DNR and their ability to do that, you know, when we're talking about rural Minnesota and especially our more forested areas is really important too. So I just wanted to mention that as well. And like Representative Moeller, really voiced my strong support for the Hometown Heroes Act. I think it is the least we can do for these people that do so much for our communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfeld. Senator Ingebrigtsen, I see your hand is still up. Is that a new hand or?
No, oh, I'll take it down. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
I just want to make sure. Others? Oh, Chair Limmer.
Just a quick question. This one is for Representative Becker-Finn. Representative, we've heard of the need on law enforcement on tribal communities. Do we have that same issue with fire departments in tribal communities as well?
Chair Beckerfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for that question, Chair Limmer. I can't speak for every tribal communities. As you know, there are 11 different nations within this the borders of what we call Minnesota. At least at Leech Lake, we don't, you know, they don't have, you know, what you would think of as a, you know, a fire department at the same level, but they, as what we think of when we think of our larger fire departments. But again, it's usually that working together in rural Minnesota in particular, you know, where you don't know, you know, depending upon what area it's in, you might have folks from several different departments responding to calls just based on who tends to be closest to where that happens. But certainly there's a lot of cross-jurisdictional cooperation to make sure that folks are helping as much as they can. I do know that, you know, like Leech Lake has their own EMS, and that is, if you live in the Cass Lake area, you know, whether you are native or not, it is the Leech Lake Ambulance Service that serves people. And so, you know, that, you know, this is part of that jurisdictional piece. And I thank you for bringing that up, as I don't think we have talked about that provision in the House bill very much, of making sure that we are treating our tribal police departments at the same level as a city or county law enforcement agency. And but yeah, I really appreciate the question, because it takes a lot of working together to make sure that in an emergency, the people can get there as quickly as they can.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman, one other quick question. I noticed that this money, is it correct that it would flow through the OJP? And if that's correct, why aren't we using the state fire marshal or the Board of Firefighter Training and Education boards? Why are we going through OJP on this? Can anyone answer that question?
Yeah, I wonder if Chief Espenson can weigh in.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Senator Limmer. So the reason that the bill was designed this way is because MnFIRE, in its 5 years of existence, has gotten very deep into the best way to structure these kinds of things, and we also have exceptionally low overhead and and so it was viewed as being an efficient way to deliver the curriculum and not be distracted by other kinds of missions that are
you know, present in some of those bigger organizations. So that's it in a nutshell.
Mr. Chairman, are these other organizations, are they first aware of the OJP funding avenue, and are they in agreement with it, or are they, is there a potential food fight over this?
Chief Espenson.
Chair Mariani and Senator Limmer, we have talked at length with many of the different stakeholders and have not heard anything negative. People are very much in favor of using MinFire as the vehicle. And while we are a relatively young organization at 5 years old, we've developed a reputation earned, I believe, as being a top flight nonprofit in the state of Minnesota, highly ranked by GuideStar. And we keep our financials on the front of our webpage for complete transparency. And then just also for clarity, I will not and have not taken any money from MinFire. My family contributes money to MinFire, and I take days off work like today and nights and evenings to do the work of MinFire. It's a passion of mine after going to way too many hospital visits and funerals.
Thank you.
Chair Limmer.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you for the questions, Chair Limmer. Any others? All right. Then, if not, Chief Jungman and Chief Espenson, thank you for joining with us today and providing some deeper information about these proposals before us. All right. So, members, next we'll walk through the emergency response provisions in the House. There are four of these, one authored by Representative Edelson, addressing 911 emergency telecommunications service account, the other by Representative Igel, establishing a telecommunicator working group, and then Representative Mecklen expands the metro, definition of the metro area is expanded. This is for 911 emergency services to add in two more counties to that service area in that system. And then Representative Marquardt's emergency management readiness grant funding for local planning and preparedness efforts. So I'm going to ask our legal staff, nonpartisan legal staff, to walk us through those provisions, and then we'll hear testimony from two testifiers.
Mr. Chair, this is Jeff Diebel again.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The first bill on the agenda is House File 2215. This is Representative Edelson's bill to authorize 911 proceeds to be used to offset the costs of updating and maintaining systems to comply with the next generation IP-based 911 telecommunications. The proposal directs unspent funds to be appropriated for the designated uses and funds, and it repeals the decrease in the funds scheduled to take place upon ARMR's backbone revenue bonds being paid off. And I didn't mention this is in Article 19 of the House side, Section 12. Mr. Chair, moving on to the next bill, it's House File 515, Representative Igo's 911 Telecommunicator Working Group. This is a proposal that's been in the legislative discussion for the last 12 months. It would establish a 911 telecommunicator working group, and it tasks the group with defining what a 911 telecommunicator is and recommends training and continuing education requirements for certification as a 911 telecommunicator. And then it also recommend standards for certification of 911 telecommunicators and funding options for mandated telecommunicator training. The Senate has an identical provision, except that the working group has less members in the Senate side. There are a few additional members as well. The Senate does not task the working group with looking into incident response command structure, which is required in the House language. Mr. Chair, that brings us to the third P piece of this part of the agenda. That's House File 1557. And this is a bill that was introduced last year as well. And it would expand the definition of metropolitan area as that term is used in the 9/11 emergency communications chapters in the statute. And as the chair mentioned, it would add additional counties to that definition. And it makes additional conforming changes in sections 9. Well, the whole bill is contained in sections 9, 11, and then 13 through 15 of Article 19 of the House proposal. The final bill on the agenda under emergency communications is Representative Marquardt's House File 499. And this is contained in the House Appropriations article on R7. And it's a rider, and it would appropriate funds each year to the emergency management grants to counties, tribes, and cities of the first class. And this is, I believe, a one-time appropriation, but Mr. Walls can correct me if that's not correct. Mr. Chair, that covers the four items listed on the agenda under this subject matter.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Members, we now have two testifiers that will speak to these provisions and to statewide emergency response issues generally as well. First, we'll hear from Kevin Reed, Deputy Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management at DPS. Mr. Reed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Kevin Reed. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Public Safety's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. I'll keep my remarks brief today. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about House File 499. This bill will support the vital role that county, tribal, and city emergency managers play in their jurisdiction's ability to prepare for, respond to, and recover from emergencies and disasters. I would like to touch quickly on two areas today, the COVID-related and the disaster emergency-related emergency management work in Minnesota. Focus on COVID pandemic response over the last 14 and a half months, county, tribal, and city emergency managers have played and continue to play a critical role in the procurement and distribution of personal protective equipment, supporting local testing sites, and the local vaccination efforts along with their local public health partners. For example, I happened to be out in the city of Spicer on Tuesday afternoon, and I was speaking with the county emergency manager from Kandy, Ojai County, and discussing just how it's gone in the local area of generally the Wilmer area in Kandy, Ohio County, on their vaccination site, their testing, their challenges with some of the agricultural business that keep them going as a critical infrastructure. All those things that she's been doing for the last 14 months as a one-person emergency management shop. Even though the $3 million emergency management readiness grants wasn't in the governor's budget recommendations, we can validate the need for the non-federal money to support the local emergency management programs. We aren't appropriated any state money currently to support the local emergency management programs, and currently we pass through 55%, or about $3.4 million, of our federal grants that we receive annually from FEMA. For perspective, on if you look across all 50 states, the average is about 45%. So Minnesota is about 10% above average of pass-through money to the local jurisdictions. Most counties then provide only the required non-federal match to meet the grant requirements. This is a 50-50 grant. In greater Minnesota, the average county emergency manager is only part-time. So that makes these days, they're accepting a lot of risk when it comes to being ready for the next flood, tornado, active shooter, fighter, et cetera. One of the most important things about this language of House File 499 is the prohibition of supplanting existing local funds in order to make sure that the readiness program grants add to the local emergency management capabilities. This projects $28,000 grant per jurisdiction. It would almost double the amount of investment in the emergency management for most counties. This grants would balance the responsibility for emergency preparedness between local, state, and federal government. Now, setting aside the pandemic response, as Director Kelly and I have testified in recent sessions, emergencies and disasters are trending upwards in Minnesota. And over the last 3 years, we've been averaging 10 state declared disasters and one federally declared disaster each of those years. And those are the only events that are large enough to qualify for disaster assistance. Local communities are dealing with hundreds of incidents that don't even qualify for disaster assistance each year. And they rely on the emergency managers to support those response to and to guide them through the recovery phases of all those disasters. Once again, I want to thank you for the opportunity, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Yes, if you could stand by, I would greatly appreciate it. Next, we'll hear from Dana Walbert, Director of Emergency Communications Network. Please come forward, state your name for the record, give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dana Wahlberg, and I'm the Director of the Emergency Communication Networks Division of the Department of Public Safety. It's my privilege to address you today and to share some trends in the field of 911 and emergency response. Every day, events across communities in Minnesota require a public safety response. And without a reliable network of interoperable emergency communication systems that include both the ability to transport voice and data, the response to these events can suffer. The ability of emergency responders to communicate between and across disciplines, agencies, and jurisdictions is critical to establishing command and control at an incident scene, maintaining situational awareness, and ensuring public safety. However, as a number of after-action reports and other assessments have revealed, there are still communications deficiencies that affect the ability of emergency responders to manage routine incidents, as well as to support the response to special events, disasters, emergencies, and acts of terrorism. Reliable, timely, and interoperable communications of both voice and data between and amongst 911 call centers, which we also refer to as public safety answering points or PSAPs, along with emergency responders and community members, is a vital component to the effective delivery of public safety services and in many cases to saving lives. This collaboration of mission-critical networks is referred to as the Emergency Communication Ecosystem. The Emergency Communication Ecosystem is a dynamic. Not everyone is needed every day, depending on the incident, the events, the access to information, and the technologies that are used. It is also multi-directional, as anyone can initiate emergency communications. The ecosystem is comprised of networks of people, technologies, and processes. Together, these components create a system of systems that plays an important part in ensuring the interoperability, the operability, and the continuity of overall emergency communications. Minnesota has four primary systems: 911, land mobile radio, wireless broadband, an integrated public alert and warning system, which we refer to as IPAWS. These four core program systems provide PSAPs and emergency responders with interoperable emergency communication capabilities. ECN plays an integral role in supporting the operations of these systems. My testimony today will focus on the DPS ECN 911 program, as well as on the wireless broadband initiative program in the state of Minnesota. The first 911 systems in Minnesota were implemented in the cities of Windham and St. James in 1968. Expanding 911 coverage statewide involved the passage of legislation, the establishment of a funding mechanism, and statewide assistance to counties and cities in order to provide this essential public safety service to Minnesota residents and visitors. Chapter 403 of the Minnesota State Statutes was passed by the Minnesota Legislature in 1977, requiring each county to develop a plan to implement 911. Currently, 911 calls in Minnesota are routed to 104 public safety answering points through a state-supported legacy network that is maintained by a number of private sector partners. Each year, our PSAPs receive close to 3 million 911 calls, the vast majority of which today are made from wireless devices. In fact, that's 85% of our calls today. Since its inception over 50 years ago, the 911 network has struggled to keep pace with rapidly changing technology. Network infrastructure that was originally intended to carry and receive voice calls from fixed locations and to transfer only minimal amounts of data are now expected to provide an accurate location for callers using these mobile devices. Think wireless cellular phones and voice over IP soft phones. In addition, this network is now expected to accommodate the transmission of text messages, photos, and videos provided by callers requesting emergency services. In short, the public expects to communicate with their smart devices in the same manner they communicate with one another. To meet these expectations, significant planning and infrastructure investments are necessary to achieve the desire of accessing the 911 network from any device, anytime, anywhere. This is a massive undertaking, not only in Minnesota, but across the nation. As early as 2010, DPS ECN recognized the need to begin the transition to next generation 911, or NG911. Moving to this technology, we drafted a 911 strategic plan. This plan laid the foundation for the actions necessary to ensure that the current and future requirements for those requesting, as well as for those providing emergency services, are met. As a starting point for this migration path, between 2012 and 2014, a portion of the old technology legacy network from the selective routers to all 104 PSAPs was replaced. It was replaced with new technology digital IP network that would allow for the eventual transport of digital media in addition to voice traffic. This was a prerequisite enhancement for developing any subsequent next generation 911 features, including text to 911. Since we have implemented text to 911, Minnesota's deaf and hard of hearing community, which comprises approximately 20% of our state's population, depend on text messaging to communicate, and we're a driving force to implement an IP-enabled next gen 911 system. In December of 2020, Minnesota celebrated 3 years of providing text to 911 capabilities to the public. Text to 911 capabilities have been deployed statewide. In 2019, PSAPs fielded approximately 7,000 text to 911, and again, that same number in 2020. Similar to a statewide text to 911 deployment, by July 1st of 2021, we will implement telephone CPR as required by legislation passed in 2019. Minnesota PSAPs are in the process of training and preparing a statewide standard for ensuring that they are compliant with either being trained to provide telephone CPR for 911 callers reporting a cardiac arrest, or that they are trained to identify a cardiac arrest and transfer the caller to a secondary medical PSAP to provide telephone CPR. While we have accomplished a lot, and Minnesota is an early adopter for next generation 911 technologies nationally, there is much work yet to be done to bring us to an end state. All of these technology upgrades require additional funding, and it amplifies the need for understanding the critical role our 911 public safety telecommunicators play in the emergency communication ecosystem. We must provide our PSAPs with increased funding, and we must ensure that they are properly trained to manage increasing levels of responsibility. And now let's briefly take a look at our wireless broadband program and its relationship with FirstNet. In October 2017, Governor Mark Dayton provided notice that Minnesota was officially opting in to participate in the FirstNet implementation. Since that time, DPS-ECN and the Statewide Emergency Communication Board Wireless Broadband and Applications Committee have continued to work closely with AT&T and the FirstNet Authority to monitor the status of the network infrastructure build-out, which is scheduled to be completed in 2023. Our wireless broadband program is aligned closely with the First Responder Network Authority, or FirstNet Authority, which is an independent authority within the U.S. Department of Commerce. Authorized by Congress through the Middle Tax Relief and Job Creation Act of 2012, the authority's mission is to oversee the development, implementation, and operation of a nationwide public safety broadband network. The purpose of this network is to equip emergency responders with dedicated cellular communication capabilities, both voice and data, to save lives and to protect property. AT&T is the cellular service provider that was awarded this 25-year contract to deploy the National Public Safety Broadband Network across all 50 states and 6 territories. This initiative, branded as FirstNet by AT&T, is the only nationwide wireless broadband communications platform dedicated to America's public safety community, and as such, it is different from services offered by other carriers. Operating on a special spectrum known as Band Class 14, FirstNet provides a dedicated public safety network core that provides emergency responders with enhanced quality of service and priority and preemption on an always-on and available 24/7 basis. It also encrypts network traffic within the core, creating a highly secure environment that public safety requires. DPS-ECN has already had opportunities in both the Operation Safety Net and the Northern Lights Task Force Communication Group initiatives to partner with multiple agencies and jurisdictions across the state, along with the FirstNet Authority and AT&T, to successfully augment communication capabilities between and amongst disparate public safety user agencies during these high-profile events in our state. As new and innovative technology, devices, applications, and other services are developed and introduced, and they are with regularity, DPS-ECN and the SECB Wireless Broadband and Applications Committee will continue their efforts to ensure that cellular voice and data needs of Minnesota's public safety community are met. And with that, I will complete my testimony, and I thank you for the opportunity to share some of our trends in public safety communications.
Thank you, Ms. Wahlberg, and I learned a new important frame, emergency communication ecosystem, and it's quite mature in our state. And it sounds like it's continuing to evolve. It has new challenges, and it certainly sounds like we've got some great public servants at the helm of, you know, directing all that. So thank you for being one of those. Members, questions, comments? Chair Lover.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. As I've been looking at this, I began to realize that this project would be available to all cities in the state of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Ms. Wahlberg?
Or is it counties? I'm not sure.
I'm sorry, which one are you referring to? I'm sorry.
The last one, Ms. Chair. The grant funding that Ms. Wahlberg described.
Very well. Yeah, Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lehner. It would go with our current grant funding, that is, to the tribal nations, the counties, and the cities of the first class, which is Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. other than that, it's the counties.
Yeah, the reason I asked, Mr. Chair, is I can understand why smaller cities would want to be available for this, but the larger cities of the first class, do they not have enough resources on their own to augment this type of program?
Deputy Director Reed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limerick, as we were looking at this, we put that $3 million into the current formula. That's the mechanism we currently have. If there was some difference, then that would be a legislative discussion.
Well, I don't know if I have a particular bent on it one way or the other. Just raising the question that a lot of times we focus these types of emergency grants into the outstate areas, but we kind of leave the bigger cities to kind of fend for themselves. And I was just wondering if this was a new direction or not. I don't know if our finance people can weigh in on this or not, but, and I don't know if I really need to have that much information, but I was just wondering.
And so, Chair Lemmer, you're looking at the, just trying to understand the inquiry. It has to do with the current way in which we are doing some level of a state match, or whether or not this proposal will impact that in a dramatically different way.
Yeah, I was really talking about the distribution of funds, and certainly our rural friends don't always have the resources that the bigger cities have, especially cities of the first class. But I also know that cities of first class also have some unique challenges of their own as well. And I was just wondering if there had ever been a distinction on funding of this kind before, where it omitted the bigger cities, cities of the first class or not.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Deputy Director Reed, if you have any background information about whether any of those, conversations have been had. I mean, I think there is a compelling argument about particularly greater Minnesota communities' capacity issues relative to this work. I know that, some of our larger entities are often called upon in a very formal way to respond to, but I don't think that replaces the local capacity issues. So at any rate, any historical, information or background or conversations or trends that you could share that might be helpful to us.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, this language came from the locals. This is not an agency directive. So when we looked at that funding as the pass-through agency, that went into our current funding mechanism. I'm not aware of any time that I've been in, any time that they've been excluded.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I looked over the authorship of the Senate version of this bill, and they were all outstate legislators. And so I know that they probably have a very keen interest in this bill. And I was just following up if they were trying to gang up on the big cities or not. But,
I think it's a fair inquiry, Chair.
We have a little more information. Thank you.
And I did try to get the individual that Representative Chair Markwright brought in. I'm forgetting what greater Minnesota community he's from. He would have been an excellent testifier today. Unfortunately, I was unable to access him, but perhaps this is something we can follow up together on. Very well. Let's see, I've got, looks like I have Ms. Carly Stark, who wants to speak on the 911 fund extension issue. Ms. Stark.
Actually, I was just going to answer the question about Greater Minnesota and the
Management Bill. That's great. Yeah, please.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Carly Stark, and I'm from the Association of Minnesota Counties. And from what I understand, They wanted to distribute it evenly, and that was supported by the Emergency Management Association, which does include bigger cities and counties as well as the smaller ones. The grants will make more of a difference in rural Minnesota just because of, you know, the difference in funding mechanisms in the cities and large counties and smaller ones. So, for example, some of the small counties, their total budget would be around $30,000, which is not a big budget for emergency management. So the $30,000 would go a lot farther there than it will in the cities. And I think this was something that was agreed upon by the association.
Yeah, and I'm recalling Director Reed's testimony on the reality of, you know, part-timers, essentially, you know, in many of these greater Minnesota communities. And so, you know, it lends, you know, some support for the argument of, you know, dollars going a much, you know, longer way, farther way, you know, in those locales. All right, very well. I do see a hand up from Kyle Older. I apologize if I mispronounced your name, from Rock County. And I think you want to weigh in on this.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate your mind hearing me. I'm Kyle Older. I'm the County Administrator and Emergency Management Director for Rock County. Rock County, we were part of working with Senator Weber on the Senate side and getting the legislation introduced. The $3 million would be split evenly between 102 entities if they asked. Each county would need to apply through Homeland Security Emergency Management. So that would be the 87 counties, the 11 tribal nations, and the four cities of the first class. And unlike EMPG, which is allocated based on population, this one would be divided in equal shares. So it would be roughly, and I'm rounding, and I can't get you the exact number, but it would be roughly $29,500 per entity. So Minneapolis and Rock County receive the same amount of dollars in this particular pot of money, not in the EMPG formula, which the state already manages. And what this is, I believe, is trying to bring us up in the one cog of the emergency management leg of the planning piece to make sure that the planning in Rock County is as solid as it is in a Hennepin or Ramsey County, any of those areas. And that's really what the intent of the legislation is. Right now, Rock County's EM budget, we get about $18,000 from the feds. We are required to match it dollar for dollar. So the EM, the emergency management planning in Rock County is about a $36,000 a year budget, roughly about a third of my time. My office's time is allocated to emergency management. Certainly the dollars from the state would bolster emergency management in counties, you know, let's say, well, I think it's safe to say all counties. It would be a real shot in the arm. And to piggyback on what Deputy Director Reed said earlier, the demand on emergency management, I've been in this chair since 1993. The demand on emergency management has leaped forward over time, and the need for this type of work continues. Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing me, and I'll stand by for questions.
Very well, very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Older. Others? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Older, Ms. Stark, Deputy Director Reed, and Director Wahlberg. I learned quite a bit. I'm always learning in this particular area. Some really good, regional equity issues being advanced with these proposals. All right, so members, the third part of our discussion today will then be focused on DWI enforcement provisions. There are two that we're focusing on in the House bill, Representative Mueller's DWI license reinstatement reform, and then the Representative Cleavorn expanding DWI ignition interlock program. And I'm terribly sorry that I wasn't able to get this in earlier when Senator Latz was here, because I know he has a deep interest in these issues, as does Chair Limmer as well. Let's proceed. I'm going to ask again our House legal staff, nonpartisan staff, to do a brief walkthrough of these provisions, and then we'll take some testimony, and then we'll open up for questions and comments.
Mr. Chair, this is Ben Johnson with House Research. I'll walk through these two provisions when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, all of these provisions appear in Article 15 of the House bill. If you're looking at the side-by-side, they begin on page R1 of that side-by-side. The provisions are sort of intermixed, and they come from both House Files 502 and 1199. Section 1 removes the requirement that a person whose license was revoked for driving under the influence of alcohol or other substances take an examination before being eligible for reinstatement of driving privileges. Section 2 makes several changes. It establishes that the Commissioner of Public Safety may not reinstate the driver's license of a person who committed a second DWI violation in 10 years or a third violation in the person's lifetime until the Commissioner certifies that the person has met one of two requirements. The first requirement is that the person did not own or lease a vehicle or commit a violation of the traffic or driver's license statutes at the time of the arrest or between that arrest and when the person becomes eligible for reinstatement. The second condition is that the person uses an ignition interlock device in compliance with state law. These new provisions require use of the interlock for 1 year if the person committed a second DWI violation in 10 years or a third violation in the person's lifetime, and for 2 years if the violation involved an alcohol concentration of twice the legal limit or more, or the person refused to submit to an authorized test. Sections 3 and 4 of the bill, which appear on pages R2 and R3, both make conforming changes. Moving to Section 5, which is on page R3, this section requires issuance of what are called new registration plates as opposed to the special registration plates, which are better known as whiskey plates. It requires issuance of those new registration plates if the person becomes a program participant in the Ignition Interlock program. That applies unless the person has previously received new registration plates under this section, but then the person either left the program or was expelled before completing it. This section also provides that if the person is issued special registration plates after leaving or being expelled from the Ignition Interlock program, and the person has already previously paid the fee for the new registration plates, there's no additional fee for the special registration plates. It also provides that the commissioner shall issue a plate impoundment order if the person who received new registration plates and is in the Ignition Interlock program ceases to participate in the program or fails to successfully complete the program due to either additional moving violations or violations of the terms of the contract. Moving on to Section 6, this is on page R5, and it simply makes a conforming change. Section 7, which is also on page R5, removes the ability of a person to obtain a limited license if the person also has a restricted license under the Ignition Interlock program. This is essentially a technical fix, but a limited license permits individuals to drive at specific times and for specific purposes, such as going to treatment or sometimes going to work. A restricted license under the Ignition Interlock program permits a person to drive at any time as long as the person is driving a vehicle equipped with the Ignition Interlock device. Section 8, which is on page R7, requires Ignition Interlock companies to include a provision in their contracts that agrees to pay for any costs associated with device failure or malfunction or any damage caused during device installation, servicing, or monitoring. And finally, Section 9, which is on page R8 of the side-by-side, limits the requirement that a person seeking to participate in the Ignition Interlock program show a motor vehicle insurance certificate to individuals who have prior convictions for driving without insurance. It's limited to that class of people. It also removes the requirement that a person seeking license reinstatement comply with the provisions in the section of law regarding limited licenses and inserts the requirements that the person complete a chemical dependency treatment or rehabilitation if that is recommended by a chemical use assessment. The section also removes the requirement that the restricted license of a person who submits a sample showing breath alcohol concentration of 0.02 or higher be canceled, and replaces that with the requirement to restart the time period the participant must participate in the ignition interlock program in order to reach the required abstinence period. Mr. Chair, that completes the walkthrough of the DWI-related sections in Article 15.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate it. With that, then, members, we're going to hear from David Bernstein, who's with the DWI, statewide DWI task force. Welcome, Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, members. Thank you for having me this afternoon. My name is David Bernstein, and I am the chair of Minnesota's DWI task force. I'll tell you briefly about the DWI task force for those who are not familiar, and then I do want to discuss generally the benefits of ignition interlock, and I'll go through the different elements of House File 502. The DWI task force was founded in 1982. It was chaired for 35 years by University of Minnesota professor Steve Simon, not to be confused with our Secretary of State, but Professor Simon is a legend in his own right. I was fortunate to have been elected chair of the task force in 2014 and have served in that capacity since then. We are not funded. We are not affiliated politically or otherwise. We are a purely volunteer organization. We have monthly meetings, which lately have been over Zoom, but otherwise we meet monthly in person, discussing DWI legislation, discussing case law, DWIs in the media, and keeping up with trends. One of the things I'm very proud of is our very, very diverse membership. We are a group of individuals and are there in our individual capacity, but we have a wide range of perspectives represented on the task force. There are judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, probation officers, law enforcement, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Minnesotans for Safe Driving, the Minnesota Office of Traffic Safety, the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance, the Minnesota Department of Health, private businesses. So we really get a complete picture of all areas of DWIs. We're concerned about prevention. We're concerned about enforcement. We're concerned about the judiciary process, both prosecution and defense. We're concerned about probation, and we're concerned about treatment. And we really try to address all of those areas. Our goal ultimately is to eliminate impaired driving and to keep Minnesota's roads safe. And that brings us to ignition interlock. The task force has been a long time supporter and proponent of ignition interlock. Statistics have shown that it does save lives, and it does keep our roads safer. I submitted a letter to this committee citing to some statistics. I'm sure you've read it, but it bears repeating that while ignition interlock is installed, there are 94% fewer DWI offenses. Recidivism goes down amongst graduates by 39%. So it is a very effective means of ensuring that individuals drive sober on Minnesota's roads. For those who aren't familiar, the way ignition interlock works, it attaches to the car's system to start the vehicle. And when an individual starts the vehicle, they're required to blow into a breath tube, and that measures the person's alcohol concentration. And if that measures at 0.02 or above, the car does not start. Ignition interlock also requires what are called rolling retests. So while someone is driving, it requires someone to blow at regular intervals to ensure that they don't consume alcohol after driving. So it is a very effective way of ensuring that individuals do not consume alcohol while driving. There are many other benefits to ignition interlock. It does remove burden on family members and helps offenders maintain employment. Offenders themselves can drive as opposed to relying on other people to give them rides, and it allows them to go to work and to make a living for their families. In addition to that, there is a huge economic benefit and impact to impaired driving. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars on DWIs in various ways, including enforcement, including the judicial system, but also there are hundreds of millions of dollars spent on medical damage, property damage, lost productivity. And so there is a huge economic benefit to preventing impaired driving as well. And Ignition Interlock does that. Right now, Ignition Interlock is severely underutilized. As of February of 2020, the Department of Vehicle Services indicated to me that there were roughly 10,500 enrollments in the program. By comparison, Minnesota over the past several years has averaged close to 30,000 DWI offenses per year, and that's new DWI offenses. Even during 2020 and the pandemic year, driving went down, and yet DWI numbers were still over 20,000 arrests for 2020. When you consider that there are 10,500 enrollments, that's not 10,500 out of 25,000, because we're talking about the fact that it takes DWIs a number of years to reach a resolution in the courts. There are new arrests every day. There are often delays in obtaining blood or urine samples before a case is charged. So there are tens of thousands of DWIs that occur every year that accumulate, and yet only a fraction of those individuals are enrolled in Ignition Interlock. There are a number of reasons why that is the case. And again, the benefit of the DWI task force is we have a number of perspectives that have identified some of those reasons. And so the provisions of House File 502 address certain barriers and incentives that would allow for more individuals to enroll in Ignition Interlock or incentivize them to enroll. And when I refer to House File 502, I'm referring to the Public Safety Omnibus Bill, Article 15, Sections 1, 6, 7, and 9. And I'll go through each of those to summarize what it is that we are proposing. I do want to note at the outset, the DWI Task Force has worked on these provisions for several years. When I became chair in 2014, we were already working on these measures. There was a bill introduced in the 2015 legislative session, House File 1255, Senate File 1013, and we've been working on this ever since. So we have worked on these for a number of years, and they've been vetted quite a bit. Last year, there was a bill introduced. There was a surprising fiscal impact, a fiscal note that was filed, and the DWI Task Force has worked with DVS, had a number of conversations, and we introduced an amendment in the House bill this year that resolved the fiscal impact. And so I'm proud to say that the bill as currently written in House File 502 and in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill is fiscally neutral. It does have support of Republicans and Democrats, as evidenced by the fact that there are authors on both sides in both the House and the Senate. So the four provisions of this bill. First, it proposes eliminating the DWI written test. I focused my testimony so far on Ignition Interlock, but another goal is to have valid drivers on Minnesota's roads that have valid driver's licenses. That's true because people who drive without valid licenses are more likely to drive without valid insurance. And so we want every driver on the road to have a valid license and to have valid insurance. One of the barriers to obtaining a valid license historically has been the DWI written test. It pre-COVID, at least, it required offenders to travel to a testing center. And here in the metro, where there are alternative means of transportation, that might be easier. But in outstate and rural Minnesota, it's very difficult for someone to go to a testing center, especially when they don't have a valid driver's license and aren't legally able to drive themselves. And the nearest testing center could be hours away. And so individuals would not get a valid license and continue to drive illegally. The DWI written test is in addition to the normal test to obtain a valid driver's license. It asks DWI-specific questions. The reason why this is unnecessary is that in every court case, someone charged with a DWI is required to go through mandatory DWI education. They often obtain an assessment, and that is specific to that offender. And so the DWI written test is superfluous. It's not necessary. It is a barrier to obtaining a valid driver's license. So eliminating the DWI written test would allow more drivers to obtain a valid driver's license and drive a valid proof of insurance, which would keep our roads safer. The second proposal would be to limit the insurance certificate requirement to those with previous insurance violations. We have received feedback on the DWI task force that individuals attempt to obtain this insurance certificate, what's called an SR22 from their insurance company. That can be a complicated process for individuals. It can result in many delays. And we've received feedback that some people say, you know what, this isn't worth the hassle, especially when I'm trying to enroll an ignition interlock that I'm going to have to pay for. It's just easier to drive illegally. We want individuals to have insurance, and everyone who applies for ignition interlock is required to have valid insurance. But the insurance certificate is an unnecessary requirement that goes beyond having valid proof of insurance. Now, we do think that is an appropriate requirement for those who have previous insurance-related violations. In that case, that's an extra check on those individuals that is appropriate given their history. But for those who do not have a history of insurance violations, it's unnecessary, and we believe that removing this requirement would convince more people to enroll in ignition interlock and enroll faster in ignition interlock, and that's a positive. The third proposal would be to change the license status for those enrolled in ignition interlock. Currently, individuals obtain a limited license, and our proposal would be to change that. So rather than have a limited license, individuals would have a valid license with an ignition interlock restriction. The biggest feedback we've gotten on this has been from our probation officers. The limited license restriction is incredibly restrictive. It restricts the hours that an individual can travel. It restricts the places that an individual can travel to, and basically restricts that to one workplace or to treatment. And so individuals who work multiple jobs are no longer able to do so. They're not able to transport their kids to medical appointments. They're not able to pick up groceries for their families. Those who are retired and do not work may not be able to drive at all with these restrictions in place. Ignition interlock ensures that individuals drive safely on the roads, and that accomplishes what we want to accomplish. And so the restrictions of the limited license are unnecessary and excessive, and ignition interlock accomplishes what we want to accomplish. Probation officers have said that people choose not to enroll in ignition interlock because they do not want to be subject to the restrictions of the limited license. And so changing this license status will be a huge incentive for people to enroll in ignition interlock and get more people into the program. The last proposal would allow an individual who is subject to a required special registration plate, or what is commonly known as a whiskey plate, a WX plate, to avoid that requirement if they enroll in ignition interlock. Whiskey plates, for those who are unaware, it basically has a WX on the license plate. It was initially used as a tool for law enforcement to be aware that someone was convicted of DWIs, and they conducted traffic stops on that basis. The Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that that is unconstitutional. So there is no value to special registration plates, and yet that requirement still exists. Instead, ignition interlock keeps our roads safer. And whiskey plates are often considered a tool for public shaming. And so if an individual is able to avoid that whiskey plate, to avoid public shaming, and instead enroll in ignition interlock, which keeps our roads safer, that's a huge incentive for individuals to enroll. And we believe that will significantly increase enrollment in ignition interlock. That's actually why DVS filed the fiscal note, is because of lost funds for whiskey plates. And we were able to work on redistributing some fees so there would be no lost funds. But DVS also anticipates increased enrollment in interlock if we remove this whiskey plate requirement. So if this committee agrees to pass these provisions, the enrollment in ignition interlock will increase and our roads will be safer. The sooner we can do this, the safer our roads will be. And that's why I really, really appreciate this committee considering these provisions. I'll close by thanking Representative Moeller and Representative Baker for authoring the House version of the bill, and Senator Latz and Senator Johnson for authoring the Senate version of the bill. As I mentioned, it's received bipartisan support. There's been zero opposition, and I noted in my letter to this committee that there are, I believe, 10 organizations that have filed letters of support in favor of these provisions. So I greatly appreciate your consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Just to show you how much I don't know, let me ask a very simple question. So what's to avoid someone else blowing into your interlock tube? How do we deal with that?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair. So the ignition interlock system has cameras installed, and it actually takes a photograph of the individual blowing into the system. Ignition interlock is monitored not only by the ignition interlock provider, but also by the probation officer. And so those pictures are sent to those individuals, and they're aware fairly quickly if someone else is blowing into the system.
Very well. Great use of technology. I knew there was a simple answer to it, but I couldn't figure out what it was. All right. Very well. Let me open this up for comments, questions, observations. Representative Mueller, this is 502 is your bill, and so I certainly would welcome you to offer any comments as well. I know I'm catching you off guard.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, I am a co-author, strong supporter, and I guess I do have one question that I think I know the answer to, but Mr. Bernstein didn't say this, but with the whiskey plate, it's my understanding that what can happen is that multiple family members, if you have multiple cars, those plates have to get switched out on all the cars. And so, you know, it's a shaming tool, not only for the person who committed the DWI, but potentially all the other family members. If you could just address that, Mr. Bernstein, I think that's helpful.
All right, Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mueller, that's absolutely correct. The whiskey plate requirement applies to all vehicles in which the offender is listed on the title. And that includes vehicles driven by family members, whether that be spouses, children, parents, partners, anyone who that offender is listed on the title. And so it is very much a public shaming of every family member. And that has also been feedback that has been given to probation officers and other practitioners that you have innocent family members having to drive around with these whiskey plates. It is very embarrassing for these individuals who have done no wrong. Instead, again, the ignition interlock would keep our roads safer and would avoid the family members having to put these whiskey plates on their vehicles as well.
Very well. Chairman Lemmer.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I also had a question about the whiskey plates. I know that when my kids were little, I'm rather surprised. I never really talked to my children about whiskey plates, but kids seem to know what whiskey plates are. And as you're driving through town, they point out the window. Look, there's a whiskey plate guy. He's got a problem. Mm. And it's kind of like a scarlet letter. And I don't think a scarlet letter really has any need or any, it doesn't satisfy anything in any kind of illegal behavior that I can think of. I just can't fathom any of that. But when they get their new plate, is that a standard plate that they get?
Mr. Bernstein.
It's not a replacement of some other specially registered plate.
Mr. Bernstein.
Correct. Thank you, Chair Mariani, Chair Limmer. Yes, when someone would enroll in Ignition Interlock, they would receive a standard plate. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Chairman Limmer.
Well, that's good. Have we heard from law enforcement at all on their perspective on whiskey plates?
Mr. Bernstein, what can you tell us about law enforcement? Obviously, they participate in, or some aspects of participate in the task force, but what can you tell us, and I don't know if we have law enforcement folks here. I'll look, but meantime, what can you tell us?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative, Senator Limmer, Chair Limmer. We have gotten law enforcement input. I don't know that they have a strong opinion on whiskey plates in general. I can tell you that specific to this bill, we have received letters of support from the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. We also have had a lot of discussions with Minnesota State Patrol. I had conversations with Colonel Langer last year, and State Patrol, I believe, is supportive of this bill as well.
And Representative Mueller might have some additional information.
Yeah, I had chiefs and sheriffs being supportive of this, going back and looking at my notes from that as well.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman Limmer.
I know that Senator Latz is not here, but I know he did have some concerns about this particular bill, about indigent people not being able to afford ignition interlock, and he was wondering if there's a process by which those fees could be waived. Can anyone add to this discussion in light of this bill?
Appropriate question. Mr. Burns?
Chair Mariani?
Representative Clevorn, I wasn't sure you were here, but that's terrific. Welcome.
Sneaky.
Yes, thank you. I did speak with Senator Latz yesterday on Chair Limmer, you are correct. That is a concern that he has. And I'm wondering if House Research would talk about the provisions where the department could, in fact, waive fees for those who are indigent.
So House Legal Staff?
Is Ben Johnson there?
Yes, we'll flush them out here, but we'll give them a minute to catch up.
That would be awesome. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, this is Ben Johnson with House Research, and there are provisions in, I believe it's actually in law, authorizing the department to set some standards for basically reduced fee. I'm afraid I don't have those right in front of me right now to give you the details on that. If you give me 10 or 15 minutes, I might be able to dig it up. Mr. Bernstein may also have that more top of mind.
Let me turn to Mr. Bernstein quickly to see what he can offer here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I do know that there is an indigency provision. Ignition interlock providers are required to accept a certain number or percentage of individuals who are indigent and qualify for indigent funding. There's an application that can be submitted through the Department of Public Safety, and in that case, the fees are significantly reduced. Off the top of my head, I believe the installation fee is $40 and the monthly monitoring fee is $25 per month, which is significantly reduced from the standard fees. I believe there might be an ignition interlock provider logged in as well who may be able to provide more information.
Representative Mueller on this point?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to remind members that there are two different bills that we're talking about here related to the DWI. So the task force bill that Mr. Bernstein just testified to, and then there's another bill that Representative Clevorn carried, and there is an interlock provider on the call who is going to speak to that bill. And I think some of the concerns that Chair Limmer raised are maybe addressed by that provider as well.
Terrific. Chairman Limmer, follow up or should I move ahead with Representative Cleveland's bill? We can always back up.
Why don't we go back to Representative Cleveland's bill? But I did have a question of Mr. Bernstein on another issue. Well, I don't usually cross paths with him too many times, except maybe once a year. And so, and maybe I'll just ask a quick question. He can call me back on it. Does the DWI task force have any plans to look at roadside testing technology for drugs? And will these devices eventually perhaps replace interlock system, ignition interlocks? Okay.
Great question. Yeah, I actually would like to hear a quick answer, and then we will move to Cleveland, but if time permits, I certainly would love to get back to that. Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, Chair Limmer. We are actively working on this. There is a bill that was introduced this session. I believe it was heard in the Senate, and I don't think it was heard in the House. It was an oral fluid pilot project, and I am trying to look up the bill numbers. I know it was House File 925, and I will try to find the Senate companion number.
The number I have is Senate File 1177.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, so this would be roadside testing to detect the presence of drugs to determine probable cause to make an arrest. And we are very much hoping that this bill passes as well. This would create a pilot project to test the instrument to ensure that it works properly. Many other states are using these instruments. But we feel it's incumbent upon Minnesota to ensure for ourselves that it's accurate and reliable. This would not replace the ignition interlock, but it would supplement ignition interlock, because ignition interlock tests individuals who are driving a motor vehicle before the vehicle starts and as it's in motion, versus this is a tool for law enforcement to detect the presence of drugs for purposes of establishing probable cause to arrest and perhaps to get a search warrant for a subsequent evidentiary blood or urine sample. So we do hope that this provision passes as well, whether this year or next year. And this would be in addition to the ignition interlock provisions being proposed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Chairman Limmer, if you don't mind, I'd like to go forward with them, or rather Representative Clearmont.
By all means.
And then we'll come back to this for sure. Representative Cleburne, your bill, House File 1199, we did have legal House staff walk through that very quickly, but tell us about your bill, and then I understand you have someone that wants to offer some testimony on it as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and you know, if we could go straight to the testimony, I just jumped out of Conference Committee for Higher Ed, so I'm coming in late. Oh. If you could let me pull up my notes, and we could just go straight to the testifier if House has already gone through the bill itself. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you joining in so quickly. So I don't know who the testifier is. I don't have that note before me, so I'm just going to ask the person to come forward and identify themselves and give us some testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Ed Cohen with Smart Start Minnesota.
There we go, Ed Cohen. Yes, welcome.
Thank you for allowing me to come in and testify today. I don't want to spend too much time duplicating the fantastic job that David Bernstein just did in kind of recapping ignition interlock and its usefulness and how important it is as a tool for public safety. I do want to just highlight a couple of facts that he mentioned. The Department of Public Safety did a study, did a study a number of years ago in which they looked at the usage of ignition interlock. And as Mr. Bernstein said, participation has been low, and it's a problematic low. You know, revoked drivers participated about 14%. Canceled drivers enter the program at about 40%. And as Mr. Bernstein said, this is really severely underutilizing the resource that ignition interlock provides for public safety. As he stated, ignition interlock operates as a barrier to prevent people who have been drinking from driving their car. And this is the best tool that we have available in order to prevent drinking and driving incidents. What this bill does is it will require second-time offenders or offenders who have a second DUI in 10 years or a third in a lifetime, it will require that they participate in the ignition interlock program before they are relicensed. There is a small exception for people who do not own a vehicle at the time of the offense. And those people, if they do not own a vehicle at the time of the offense or throughout their withdrawal period and they have no driving offenses, those people can be exempted from the program. And in short, that is the whole of what Representative Cleavorn's bill does, House File 1199. I want to thank Representative Cleavorn for leading the charge this year. It is greatly appreciated. And this is a bill that has had wide bipartisan support. It has been through this body a number of times, including 2015 and every year except last year. It has made it to the governor's desk before, but unfortunately was vetoed as part of the giant omnibus bill in, I believe, 2018. So this is a bill that its time has come. I am hopeful that this committee can support this, and I am here to answer any questions that the committee has.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Cohen. All right, members, questions, comments, observations?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleavorn.
Yeah, I would just like to remind the committee that the purpose of this legislation was just to reduce the number of drunk driving incidents and to decrease the recidivism rates. And we believe that bringing people onto the ignition interlock, as has been stated before in the data, with their second DWI in a 10-year period or a third in a lifetime, is an opportunity for us to make our roadways safer. And I don't know if Mr. Johnson now, he did answer the question about the cost. So that has been resolved. So I would just ask for the support of the committee and thank you for to my co-authors in the Senate, Senator Coleman and Senator Bingham, and for the House members who have signed on. And I'd also like to mention that Representative Poston and Representative O'Neill worked with me on this bill in the House to make sure that the bill met a bipartisan standard in the House, and also we were protecting consumers that might be in using these devices. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn, for joining us here today. Members. Let's be getting late. Everybody wants to just get this committee over with, me included. All right. Well, Mr. Bursting, thank you for joining us here today, and Mr. Cohen. And so that then concludes our discussion of the third provision, DWI enforcement provisions in the House bill. Chairman Lumen, it is unfortunate that Senator Latz was not here. I know that he's quite involved and very passionate about these issues, but he certainly does have his priorities straight today. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this kind of goes, I don't have a question about the bills. I think all the bills presented today have been really good. They're in line with the work that we've done all session to try to make the lives of all Minnesotans better. What I do have to say is that, you know, I told folks yesterday that I was hopeful that we could get something done before our constitutional deadline that we have to stop having these meetings. And I said I took our GOP colleagues for the word and that they were behaving in good faith. But today at the beginning, we were told again or more excuses as to why there hasn't been an offer provided to the five offers that we provided. And negotiations work both ways. And if we don't have the other side participating in the negotiations, we're not going to get anything done. And my issue is that my hope is starting to fade as we get closer to the end of this constitutional deadline for us to stop having these meetings. And the problematic piece to me is that much of what we presented in terms of the policy pieces, we can get those done without targets. We've heard from Senator Latz, we've heard from other committee members that other committees, and we know, I know personally, other committees are moving forward and they're doing the work. And we seem to have these invisible barriers that are being laid out as reasons that we can't do our work. And I don't know how I can say in good conscience to anyone who's asking me if you truly believe that Black Lives Matter, or if you truly believe that we should take care of our victims, if you truly believe you should take care of our firefighters, how in good conscience can I say that we truly believe that, or at least that those are providing these invisible barriers believe that? I believe that. I know others on this committee believe that. I know that the work that we've done all session long, having those community members come in and speak to talk to these issues, drafting policies, putting them forward, including them in this omnibus bill, I know that we believe because we've been doing the work and we continue to do the work in this conference committee. I don't know if we're going to have it. I don't know if the Senate's going to gavel in tomorrow. I know we're going to gavel in on Saturday. And I got to tell you, if there's not an offer between Friday and Saturday, I can't say in good conscience that any of this is being bargained in good faith. Because everything points to the fact that it would not be bargained in good faith. It's nothing but a stall tactic to run out the clock. And that means we're running out the clock on the victims that we're trying to help and trying to prevent them from being more victims, on the DUIs we're trying to prevent, helping our firefighters, and helping our communities feel safe. If we fail to act, that's what we're telling our communities, that none of that is urgent for us. And I don't want to be a part of that. So I'm hoping we're going to get some offers tonight, tomorrow, or before the end of the day on Saturday, and definitely before the constitutional deadline. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. I share your sense of urgency and desire. And, you know, and actually today as I was listening to the testimony, I was certainly taken by just how much I believe, anyway, these two bodies have shared values and shared knowledge. And I think we can find much to agree on, even as we will have some differences. It does seem to me that that's a one should always try to emphasize where there is agreement. You know, forms the potentially the foundation for upon which we can build you know, some really good work. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. And I do want to push back a little bit against what was just said, too. There's been no effort to say no to these things either. We're still extremely open to that. In fact, if we want to move forward, our first offer is our Senate position. So if you want to consider, there has been an offer made. The Senate has made a very bipartisan position. Now, we have some differences on that, and you've presented that over the last 2 weeks. But again, there's money attached to that, breaking our target over in the Senate. So we can't move up much until we have those positions done. So for you to shame us into the fact that we aren't moving in the right direction, well, quite frankly, until we get those targets, it's extremely difficult to move without going outside of the target that we were given as a Senate and passed out bipartisanly. So I know Senator Limmer has been very committed to listening. We've been here digesting the offers that come through, and we both agree there are a lot of great ideas out there that we're really excited about as a body on coming to an agreement. But we're just waiting until we get those targets. And it's not like we figured that we'd be waiting this long. We figured that things would come together much quicker than this. So I don't think the answer is no, but I think the answer is let's come together when we have those dollars to see what the priorities are of these two committees. So I appreciate the time, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for your thoroughness in investigating the offers that you put out. You've done a very commendable job in that.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Chair Beckerfitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just, it's a bit disingenuous to blame the lack of targets when the very first offer we put forward over a week ago, same similar non-controversial things that are carried by Senate Republicans. There is no reason why we could not get that done, but we don't have, there has not been a counteroffer, and continuing to make excuses for saying no or putting forth a counteroffer is just as good as no. Either way, we're not moving anything forward. We're not getting anything done. And so, it takes two people to, it takes two sides to be engaged in getting something done. And, we're frustrated because we put forth a very in good faith, very early on, same, similar, non-controversial, civil law policy only, nothing to do with budget targets, and we haven't even gotten a counteroffer or response to those. And so we have to stop using that as an excuse for at least not getting the policy stuff done and moving forward on those items. Other conference committees are moving forward on items and negotiating in good faith on policy items, and we could do the same if the Senate was willing.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Senator Representative Frazier, I see your hand up again.
Yeah, it is up again, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Just in response, we've got to stop gaslighting Minnesotans. We can't keep gaslighting Minnesotans. We know that there's stuff that we can do. We know that there's policies that we can agree on that doesn't have a dollar amount attached to it. We've got to stop gaslighting Minnesotans to give this excuse that we can't do our job that we were elected and sent here to do because of these invisible barriers. I appreciate that you said there's a lot of good ideas here. Let's act on them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Senator Johnson, I see your hand up. Is that again, or?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would like to speak on that too. We want to talk about gaslighting. There are a number of bills that you have on the House floor. So, and there was actually a bill of mine that was a very non-controversial bill, just a harmless errors issue that's going on, that was moved back to the Ways and Means. So if you want to talk about gaslighting and putting on a show, I think there's enough blame to go around. What we're doing is trying to come together to advance our priorities, and we need targets to do that. So to say that we're gaslighting is very disingenuous. And I hope that the rhetoric kind of slows down here and we get together and get this deal done.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Members, one of the ways in which, actually the most important way in which we speak in the legislature isn't even speaking, it's by voting. That's what the history records as our presence and our action and our impact here. And I don't control the House floor. I don't think Chair Limit controls the Senate floor. But I do have a strong influence is in this committee. And I can speak in this committee by voting. And I think it's important that we do speak in that manner. You all know this, the gentle person's way to do all this work has less to do with ramming, vote throats or vote proposals at each other. It really has to do with this idea of making offers so that you think of it as an invitation to begin to stake out where we can get to agreement. And then at some point there will be a vote. And if members aren't ready for a vote, at that point you don't vote. Constructing these bills is big work. I've been involved in several omnibus bills over the years. It's not easy work, when both houses agree on many things. It's important that we be very diligent and thorough in constructing what will become law, hopefully. And so the first steps do involve identifying for one another where we can get to an agreement on a vote. And I can only share that my intention here as the chair of the House conferees has been to create that opportunity for us to do that. It certainly is disappointing that we're not seeing a reciprocal attempt, on the part of the other body, but I am eternally optimistic. I certainly have worked with Senator Limmer in the past, and we have managed to get to certain points of agreement. My hope is that we can do that again this year. It probably will require some late night work, Representative Fraser, at this stage of the game, but that's what we're here to do. Waiting for targets is not an illegitimate expectation of ourselves when it comes to making decisions around finances, of which there are plenty here. We are one of the bigger accounts. However, there's so much that is not dependent on finances that where I just know there's a strong, passion and potential agreement for. And then there are others where we can certainly negotiate our way, toward an agreement. I firmly believe that. And for us to choose to wait until we have a target to do that, handicaps us. It puts us in a bad position to be able to do the work with the kind of care that I talked about earlier. And so, it's pretty simple. If you have something in common, if you agree what is in front of you, then take the steps formally. To move those into this bill. That's all we're trying to do over in the House. And obviously we're kind of guessing, what the Senate likes. So we've put a lot of things in there, and the response, hopefully the response would be, to then identify of what we put on the table that you want to move at this point. I just really think that people expect nothing less of us than to approach our work that way. Members, we are going to conclude early today. That's not a bad thing. But I do have an inquiry about tomorrow. The Senate has a gavel tomorrow. And so I'm wondering, Chair Limmer, if you can share with us your plans and hopes for tomorrow in terms of meeting again.
Well, Mr. Chair, before I answer the question, I just wanted to reemphasize that our exercise here is to pass a funding bill, a budget bill. And, of course, there are policy decisions that are on it, but we can't pass any of those policies until we get a budget target. Because that, unless you want to pass just an all policy bill, and that's not anything that we're going to go forward with. This is a budget bill, and we are going to hope to pass a budget bill. We're in a holding pattern, as you know, regarding the other negotiations going on. Are we ever going to get to a budget target? I don't know. I was hoping that we could be done by deadline also, but the deadline doesn't seem to be in reach, at least in reference to budgets. That's our number one goal in the first year of a biennium is the budget. I have to still stay on track with that as far as our agenda for tomorrow. During our off hours, we have been looking over your 56 proposals, and now we have another page full of proposals, but they are mostly cost items. They trigger a lot of cost items, and we'll start re-examining those. It'll be another couple hours of work later today for us on the Senate side. We're not ignoring your offers. We're trying to be prepared for that eventuality that we have a budget target come into view. For tomorrow, we're going to have to let you know what we have going on. Oh, by the way, Ms. Chairman, what do you have scheduled for Saturday?
Chairman Limmer, I'm not sure yet. You know, we'll conferee. Our conferees meet at least once a day. We put our agenda together. We certainly have several provisions that we haven't covered yet. It could well be that we'll put those forward. I certainly commit to you to get you that information as early as possible.
That's good. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Senator Wimmer. Members, respectfully, the House has made, or rather, both houses, I think, have made their position rather clear. I have to say, from the House's perspective, we're pretty clear. There's nothing in our rules that says that an omnibus bill only has to be a finance, only include finance provisions. And in fact, if you look at virtually every omnibus bill that has passed here, I'm willing to wager you will never find one that's only limited to finance positions. We have the choice, we have the power to shape the bill according to the work that both our bodies have worked pretty diligently on over the course of several months. And I have to say, after some of the testimony that we heard in recent days, for me, the duty is about serving the people of Minnesota. In this case, quite frankly, it's about saving lives in the state of Minnesota. I think we can do that. I think our systems want to do that, and they need our assistance as their legislature to provide them with the authorities, the frames, and the resources to be able to do that and be better systems. And that's going to require a combination then, as I said, resources and policy. That, in my mind, and the House's position, is what makes a good omnibus bill, because it meets the realities of the people of Minnesota. And hopefully we will get to a point where, there is agreement on that point. Before I convene, I do see that Representative Mueller is asked to be recognized. So, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, it's been said that other committees are working on policy, and just by my own sort of informal survey of my colleagues, I think it's fair to say that most other omnibus committees are working on policy and getting those agreed upon items done. I know that all of the House conferees are ready to do that. And if we're not going to have meetings tomorrow, when we've got some time over the weekend, I know any of us are available to discuss various provisions of our bill. I know some different omnibus committees have formed subcommittees to look at various aspects. We're all here and we're all willing to do that. Chair Limmer, I've had the pleasure of working with some of the Senate staff on a number of occasions. I know they're fantastic. We welcome that. Senator Johnson, you and I worked together on a number of bipartisan bills, and I've enjoyed that process too. I'm here, I'm ready, I'm willing, and so are my conferees. So let's get this done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. We are here, we are willing, and we are ready. Well said. Thank you. All right. Well, members, being no further business before us, until tomorrow, this committee stands adjourned.